ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Hi there, Selena Green with you today for The Country, and well, for the next few weeks, you'll have me while Cassie Huff is off taking some leave. Trade and tariffs, how are you keeping up with it all? It's a bit of a struggle and it's changing every moment, it feels like. Today, we'll have a look at some of the nations outside of the United States that Australia is courting to try and grow our exports in what is a very convoluted and complex global trading scene. Also coming up today, some calls for celebration for South Australia's bluefin tuna industry with a big tick of approval that could see it in even more demand.
We need new markets, and that tick, that certification, that brand, that will really help us to do that.
Stick around for more on that very shortly. But first today, while the US will pause its reciprocal tariffs for 90 days, that's not going to apply to its 145% tariff on goods from China. The Shadow Minister for Trade, Kevin Hogan, says a retaliatory war would be terrible for world growth. He spoke with our reporter Kim Honan about his concerns.
One thing we don't want to see is a trade war between the US and China. So you've seen that the US have paused a lot of their tariffs down to 10% for 90 days, which I think is a good thing. As I said previously, I think the US tariff issue is a mistake from Donald Trump. I think it's going to be inflationary for the consumers in the United States. And I think if we see a retaliatory war, which we've started to see, that that's going to be terrible for world growth. And let's remember that Australia, as a country, last year sold $650 billion worth of goods and services to the rest of the world. So we're a very big exporting nation for the size of the country that we are, and we want that to continue, and we need global growth to be good, and tariffs might slow it down or even make it go backwards, which would be bad for us.
Well, now that China has stopped buying beef from the US, what kind of opportunities do you think that presents for Australian exporters? You already export beef to China.
Look, obviously in the short term, and there might be certain nuances if with this trade war between the two, that do in the short term present opportunities for Australia and our beef exports, and I understand that. But I think the bigger picture here, to go beyond beef, the bigger picture here is if this tariff war slows growth in both the United States and if it slows growth in China, that for the bigger picture for us is not good, because it means China's demand for a lot of things that we sell overseas, and they buy things like iron ore and coal and gas as well as food, that their demand for that may slow, and that would not be good.
That's Kevin Hogan, the Shadow Minister for Trade and the Nationals Federal Member for Page in Northern New South Wales, speaking to Kim Honan. Speaking of China, South Australian Wine Trade and Investment Minister Joe Sokarch is today headed off on a trade mission to China, which coincides with the one-year anniversary of the removal of tariffs on South Australian wine by the Chinese. And he'll join me later on the program from China, where he arrived this morning. But on tariffs, Mutiaroo Pastoral Company produces beef, lamb and wool in the far northeast of South Australia and believes it can weather the US 10% trade tariffs announced earlier this month. 30% of the company's income is from wool, the remaining 70% of income from red meat sales. Its managing director, James Morgan, says historically tariffs come and go, but eventually even out.
The trade tariffs that they've announced globally are a little bit frightening for some countries. In regards to Australia, I think the 10% that's been applied to particularly some of the commodities we deal in, we don't think that that's going to have too much effect on us, because, well, firstly, trade continues on and the US have a shortfall of beef, and they will require, particularly in the beef trade, they'll require beef, and it means their consumers will pay a bit more. But I think for the volume that Australia produces, and of course we, large portion of what we do, but on global terms, I think we can redirect beef if needed, or indeed the US consumers will take the beef and pay the extra. So it's disappointing, but we probably didn't get as high a level of tariffs, as I said, as a lot of other countries. So I wouldn't say we've got off lightly, because we're not happy about it, but it is part of the Trump's manoeuvring to, you know, improve the internal economics of the United States. So we understand why he's done it, but yeah, I think we'll be able to get through this and continue to trade at reasonable levels. And we also have very good internal. There'll be some strong internal restocking requirements, particularly with the rainfall that's fallen in parts of New South Wales and Queensland.
And as far as, I guess, the other market of wool, I understand with the Australian dollar being lower that it might increase demand for wool. Is that how you see it? Or
wool? Well, look, that's a good question. Markets are quite reactive, and when there is a spike in the Australian dollar either way, there is some reaction by the buying houses that are operating, particularly out of China. I mean, China will have plenty of other issues to deal with at the moment with the very hefty tariffs that they're looking like having imposed on them. So despite the fact they will be trying to offload produce elsewhere, wool is not one of those producers that they have any level of high levels of production in, and indeed they need to import wool from Australia. So, yeah, we would expect there to be a bit of a reaction to that, providing their economy doesn't get damaged too badly via these tariffs. And look, I would say about the tariffs is they've been and gone before and they do some damage, but they usually tend to get evened out or reduced at some point when the desired effect has had. Hopefully the effect is not too serious and causes a, you know, recessional type activity across the globe. We don't want to see that.
So just with your last comment there, I guess, are you hopeful that perhaps the tariffs might be changed at some point?
Oh, absolutely. Look, I don't think, you could argue that the tariffs might be there long term, but that doesn't seem to be where they sit historically. They've been used as a tool for leverage to obviously protect manufacturing internally in countries. Countries that put tariffs on are obviously that's what they're trying to do and protect their industries. But in the end, they often get modified or reduced. But I would think that President Trump's come out swinging and he's obviously putting a lot of things on the line to try and cause a reaction from the countries that they trade with. It's a bit odd with Australia because we have America has a trade surplus with us. So they clearly don't need to punish us too hard because we're already buying more produce from them than they are from us in dollar terms. So I would think that these tariffs would get modified at some point, to be honest with you, Catherine.
It's Mataru Pastoral Company Managing Director James Morgan. He's speaking there to Catherine Smackman. Takes us to 13 minutes past 12. You with Selena Green today. Well, let's stick with trade for a few more moments. And representatives from Australia's food and wine industries have been in Japan this past week, showcasing products and trying to shore up one of our most important trade relationships. Well, the trip couldn't have come at a better time, with the US President Donald Trump's tariff regime causing chaos for world exports. The seafood, meat, vegetable, dairy and wine industries are all part of the trip. Warwick Long caught up with Martin Cole, the CEO of Wine Australia, to find out more.
Yeah, so it's been going for quite a while now, since 2022, and it's funded under the Agriculture Trade and Market Access Cooperation thing. And basically, it's an opportunity to showcase Australian food and wine and to really educate different markets around what's happening and what's going well and things like that. Yeah, so great opportunity to showcase premium Australian fare in a collaborative way.
What happens on a trip like this? Like you say, showcasing it. Do people come in and do you feed them? Do you have trade
stores? 100%.
What do you do?
Yeah, 100%. So basically, when we get on ground, mostly what we do is there's usually some market specific. So for in our case, we met with sommeliers. We went to see how Australian wine is portrayed in retail. What's happening on the on-trade business. So usually there's some sector-specific things. But then most importantly, we get together. So we had a meeting at the embassy to talk about broader kind of trade relations with Japan. And then we have a whole series of events during the day which is to showcase. So in the wine case, we ran a masterclass, about 60 people attending, with one of the top sommeliers here, showcasing, you know, a diverse offering of Australian wine. And that's a masterclass. So that's really about educating about Australian wine and the different varieties. And then at the end of the night, there's a gala dinner with an opportunity. And the whole dinner is themed around food paired with Australian wine. And there's a networking event as well in between. So it's an opportunity to really, you know, kind of mingle and network with the folks that are interested in, you know, so these are importers, distributors, retailers, on-premise folks.
Given what's going on in the world right now with a lot of talk around tariffs, with uncertainty in a number of the world's largest wine-producing regions and trade areas, as I imagine you're no doubt quite aware, how important is it to do a trade mission like this? And is it even more important to be doing it now, given what's going on in the world?
Oh, 100%. I mean, this was, you know, particularly in this environment of uncertainty, it's really important that we continue to have an approach to market diversification, and that we also, you know, continue to service and build on the great relationships we have with a number of partners around the world. Japan, for wine, I mean, Japan is, for ag and food, is our third largest customer. For wine, it's our ninth largest customer. The relationship is hugely important. You know, we're a net exporter of food. Japan is a net importer of food. Our food products go into as ingredients into supporting the Japanese food industry too, but particularly now with what's going on around the world and the long-term view of how we can work together to support each other is really critical.
And since we have you away from the direct relationship with Japan, how's the Australian wine industry feeling about what's happening in the world right now in terms of tariffs? Do you think you'll be able to navigate more trade wars after coming through quite bruised after our last one?
You know, like everyone else, I think we're waiting to see how things settle. But again, what it does emphasise is, you know, the need to really get around long-term strategic trade partners to understand what. So we're trying to help DFAT and others model potential impacts of tariffs. But yeah, I mean, I think particularly at this time, it's very important that we have a market diversification strategy, that we don't put all our eggs in one basket. Everybody's kind of concerned to see how it's going to settle down.
It's what makes it harder for your industry this time around. I suppose the Chinese ban was tariffed so high that you were never going to access that market was so difficult for your industry. Yeah. But this time around, yeah, with the United States, it's so uncertain and it's changing every day. Does that bring its own set of challenges?
Oh, yeah. I think it's the uncertainty that's the biggest thing, isn't it, at the moment? I think everybody's trying to work out, you know, how things are going to land. For sure, you know, however it lands, though, the positioning of, you know, the quality of the products, the quality of offering, I think is all the more important.
Martin Cole there from Wine Australia speaking to Warwick Long about building trade relationships with Japan. Well, speaking of Japan, World Expo 2025 Osaka is a 6-month-long exhibition that takes place in Japan. It starts this week. 150 nations taking part. 28 million visitors expected to attend between now and when it wraps up in October. Australia's theme for that expo is Chasing the Sun, and visitors to the Australian Pavilion Cafe, we're told, will be able to enjoy Southern Bluefin Tuna, and there'll be South Australian lamb, beef and wine available through a mix of live demonstrations, some themed events and direct sales as well. And South Australian brewery Coopers have also supplied more than 750 cartons to supply the food cabin for the first 3 months as well. So great to see South Australia well represented at that massive event that starts this week.
Hands on buzzers, everyone.
This brand new quiz show is your favourite celebrities out to get each other.
Just wait.
Claire Hooper's House of Games, weeknights from 6:30.
The pressure is real.
Starting Monday, April 21 on ABC TV and ABC iView.
You're with Selena Green on the Country Hour today, where young people from right across South Australia are spending the first 3 days of their school holidays learning all about the sheep industry as part of the South Australian Sheep Expo. It officially kicks off today. It runs until Wednesday at the Waverley Showgrounds. It's a great way for the next generation of sheep producers to learn, to network and, well, no doubt have a bit of fun as well. Andrew Hall is on the 2025 organising committee. Hi, Andrew, and welcome to the Country Hour.
Thanks very much, Selena.
And well, you're at the expo as we speak. You've got a healthy number of participants coming from right across the state this year?
We have, yes. We've got 112 participants this year, and they all come from right across Australia. So we've been very blessed to be able to get as many as we have, considering the tough times we're all experiencing.
Tell us a bit more about the expo. You've got, these are, the future generation of sheep producers here in South Australia. So given that they're giving up their school holidays to come and be part of this, fair to say these are young people very interested in being future leaders of this industry.
Indeed they are, and this is what really, enthuses us as committee members to see such important numbers coming through that want to be part of our fantastic sheep industry, whether that's based on a meat terminal sire program or from the wool perspective, I guess. But when you've got students from the ages of 12 to 23, we've got quite a vast age group, and, we're very lucky to see them coming through and wanting to spend the time here with the sheep.
Give us an idea of what's on the program for the rest of today and also for the next couple of days. Is this a three-day event?
Yeah, three-day event, and it's a large day, as a lot of parents comment, that we're up at 6:30 in the morning and we don't go to bed till 10. So you can imagine for those 12 and 13-year-olds, it's a big, big day for them, but they certainly get the most out of it. But we're very lucky that today we've got Meat and Livestock Australia doing the official opening for us. And then from there onwards, we start off with doing certain topics along the lines of pregnancy scanning and classing ewes and learning the art of auctioneering and the ring craft for those who show their sheep in the show circuit or want to be part of helping other ones doing it. And then the most important things, like at the moment, managing ewes in dry times and also shearing and wool handling. And there's just so many topics available for the students that we're very, very blessed by having all the speakers that we do get.
As you mentioned, it's been a tough year out there, and I imagine for some of these kids too, it might be just nice for them to get off farm for a bit and come into the city and just have a good time with some other young folks and make some friendships.
It's a very valid point that you make there, Selena. A lot of the parents make comment that for the kids that have been enduring this drought for so long now, that for them to be able to come away with their friends and do something like this, it just takes them away from the hardship of what they're seeing in reality, and it also actually gives the parents a bit of a breather too for some time where they can actually just reassess their scenario and not have to worry about trying to make sure that their kids are in a position where they're not trying to reassure them about where the next meal's coming from or how the sheep are faring and all that sort of stuff.
Do you have young people who come back a second, third time? Are they repeat offenders, but have you got young people who like to come back and do multiple expos?
It's amazing you should ask that because, yeah, we're very fortunate that we've got quite a few coming back and time again. And it's like anything, you go, well, how can we rejig the program to make sure that they're not learning the same stuff year after year? But we're very lucky that we can do that. And we're very lucky that we've got a participant here who is attending for her 10th year now. And so she's attended every single Sheep Expo since 2016. So, that just shows that this is something that really inspires people to keep coming back.
Yeah, so for those who are there this week and when they head home on Wednesday or Thursday, once it's all sort of wrapped up, what are you hoping they take away with them?
I think first and foremost that they've had a great time away from home. They've networked, they've met some very like-minded people that, like for a lot of us in the industry, we'll come across each other again and build those relationships, but more so the fact that they get a great understanding that there is so many opportunities in the sheep industry and that we want to encourage them to take whichever career pathway they may want to do, because there is an endless number of jobs out there, and without them, we may not have an industry.
And Andrew, for someone like yourself and those on the organising committee who are, you know, giving up time to be part of this over not just the 3 days, but obviously all the work that goes into organising an event like this, what do you get out of it?
I guess we get to see the enjoyment on a lot of children's faces. We've got people here or participants here that have never seen, dare I say, several types of breeds. They might be familiar with a Merino, but they're not familiar with a Hampshire Down or a Texel or a Aussie White, for example. But the reality is that this opens every avenue for them potentially to be involved and for us to be able to encourage them to do something that they not be able to participate in elsewhere. It really inspires us because we get great enjoyment in seeing people coming along and being eye open to the world.
Well, Andrew, it sounds like you've got a lot happening there today. I better let you get back to it. Thanks so much for joining us on the Country Hour this afternoon.
It's been my pleasure. Thanks, Selena.
Andrew Hall, one of the members, committee members of the 2025 South Australian Sheep Expo. So today and the next couple of days at the Wavell Showgrounds, and we hope to catch up with some of the young folks who are taking part in that later on in the week. Right now it's 25 minutes past 12. You're with Selena Green. We need to head to the Weather Bureau, and happy Monday to Hannah Marsh.
Happy Monday, Selena.
And you know what? If I had no idea what the date was, Hannah, I could be tricked into thinking it's summer. It's been so warm.
Absolutely, and not only a day of the week, but we've got pretty much a rinse and repeat weather forecast as well. So what's Monday, what's Tuesday, what's Wednesday? It's all starting to look a bit the same. But that's because we're dominated by a high-pressure system that's south of the Tasman at the moment. We did have a weak cold front, which clipped the lower southeast this morning, which brought some cloud, and the Weather Watch radar showed some shower activity around, but not enough to gauge in the Bureau's network of rain gauges. We are looking at dry conditions otherwise across the state today. There is a bit of convective cloud starting to develop across the north of the state, but that cloud in the south is starting to break up. So far, maximum temperatures have been up to 35 degrees at Ceduna and Port Lincoln. Whyalla has been up to 32 so far. So has Cooper Pedy, Oodnadatta and Roxby Downs. It's been up to 31 so far at Broken Hill, 33 so far at Renmark and Murray Bridge, 31 so far for Clare. Mount Lofty has been up to 27 degrees, 26 so far at Victor Harbour, 29 at Kingscote and 23 so far at Mount Gambier. Then as we move into tomorrow, again, we're looking at those mainly dry conditions. There is some high cloud that we'll see develop, and there is the chance of seeing a spot or two in the west associated with that, but not expecting much in the way of rainfall associated with that. Maximum temperatures, we're still looking at those well above average maximums, and also warm minimums, particularly about the agricultural area, really out to mid this week. Similarly, on Wednesday, we're looking at those mainly dry conditions with those above average maximum temperatures, but they will tend near average to slightly below average in the southwest, and that's associated with a trough that we've got coming through. That trough will be fairly slow moving, really moving through from Wednesday to Friday about western and southern parts of the state, but it isn't until the weekend that it pushes through much of the state and brings those cooler temperatures associated with it. There is also a chance of seeing some shower activity developing, particularly later in the week associated with this change about western and southern parts of the state. But the models are a little bit inconsistent as to how much rainfall we'll see associated with that. But generally at the moment, out to the end of Friday, we're looking at less than 5 millimetres about the west and south, Selena.
All right. Cheers. Thanks for that, Hannah.
Thank you.
Hannah Marsh there from the Weather Bureau. Looking at the western inland of New South Wales for Tuesday, a sunny day in the upper western district with overnight temperatures between 15 and 19 degrees, during the day around 30. For the lower western district, a mostly sunny day tomorrow with overnight temperatures between 13 and 17. During the day, those temperatures are forecast to reach into the low to mid 30s. It's just coming up to 12:30 here on the Country Hour.
Australia votes. Your say.
Especially mental health. I mean, with young people right now and trying to see a psychologist, psychiatrist, it's not easy.
Here on ABC Radio.
You're listening to Selena Green on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Yes, you've got me for the Country Hour today and also for the next few weeks. Cassie Hoff is off on some leave. In a moment, a world first for South Australia's bluefin tuna industry. And I'll be crossing, hopefully, if we make an international connection, speaking to the Strait Trade Minister. He's in China, where he's spruiking our products and produce in a very interesting trade environment, say the least. But that's not until we get news headlines from Matt Coleman. Good afternoon, Matt.
Hello, Selena. In the news this afternoon, Independent State MP Nick McBride has been charged with assaulting a person known to him. SA police say a 55-year-old man from the Limestone Coast was arrested on the 10th of April at Norwood, where he was charged with three counts of assault. It says as the matter is before the courts, no further details will be supplied. The Weather Bureau says the Darling River is rising due to floodwaters, but it's too early to tell if the flows will reach the wider Murray-Darling system. Water New South Wales is predicting between 600 and 1,000 gigalitres of water will flow into the Menindee Lakes down the Darling River over the next few weeks, but a prediction on flows into the Murray is expected to be some time away. And the Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, says that if re-elected, his government will formally bid for South Australia to host a future international climate change conference. Speaking on the Labor campaign trail in Adelaide, Mr. Albanese says that hosting COP would highlight the city's commitment to clean energy and sustainability. The upcoming COP30 is set to take place in Brazil later this year. More news at 1 o'clock.
Thank you, Matt. Matt Coleman with those headlines. Well, yes, South Australia's bluefin tuna industry is celebrating a world first, and it points to some good signs for the health of the fishery. The South Australian Southern Bluefin Tuna Industry Association, they're celebrating as their purslane fishery has been certified as sustainable to the Marine Stewardship Council standard. As I said, it's a world first for southern bluefin tuna and what the industry is describing as a significant milestone due to the fact that this species was once severely overfished. Now, to receive the MSC certification, there is a set of requirements for sustainable fishing that must be met when independently assessed. And the CEO of the Southern Bluefin Tuna Industry Association, Daniel Casement, well, he explains.
Our association is really excited to be able to announce that we are the world's first southern bluefin tuna fishery to achieve a certification against the Marine Stewardship Council standard. This has been years in the making, and really it has been a journey for us around our fish being listed under the Environmental Protection, Biodiversity and Conservation Act at a federal level as conservation dependent, and as the industry and the government, so both the regulators and the researchers, we've all worked together to recover this stock to levels at which we could remove that conservation-dependent listing, which then enabled us to progress to this certification standard. So this has been many years coming, and it's something the industry has committed to over a long time.
As you mentioned, there has been concerns in the past about this species and its stock numbers. What work has the industry done to get it to the level it is now and to receive this certification?
Yeah, the industry has committed to supporting the science, to having researchers out undertaking gene tagging and tagging of our fish and all sorts of different research programs so that we best understand our stock, how they move. And then we've made the tough decisions, as all of the members of the International Commission that underpins Southern Bluefin Tuna, to reduce our quotas, reduce our catch, and make the hard decisions over a long time so that the benefits can be realised for future generations.
What do you think this will mean moving forward for the industry to have this, being able to you know, be said, we've got this certification?
Yeah, look, there's only ever one world first. So I think reputationally we can stand proud and be really clear about our environmental commitment and performance. And you know, we can say that to all of our partners and to our community and to our buyers that we are the world's best and we've been certified to that standard. I guess from there, what it does is it will ensure market access into some markets where they are really starting to drive a need for eco labels like Marine Stewardship Council. And yeah, let's hope that it means that our community and NGOs and all the people that are watching us really understand how committed to looking after our stock we are. And it'd be wonderful if it meant an uptick in our price and market opportunities and product development opportunities well into the future.
Is there opportunities for new markets with this kind of certification?
Most definitely. And so there are a number of overseas markets quite discerning around these things. So the EU, the UK, America, growing in Southeast Asia. So we certainly see all those markets really starting to see MSC or equivalents as an entry-level standard that you need to have to demonstrate your sustainability credentials.
What about here locally in Port Lincoln? Obviously, the town is known for its southern bluefin tuna. Does it future-proof the industry here in Port Lincoln?
We believe so. We believe this is very much the important step in ensuring that we continue to build our social licence. And by that, I mean, we want our community to accept everything we do and to really back our industry and our people to make sure that we have a continued bright future.
CEO of the Southern Bluefin Tuna Industry Association, Daniel Caseman. Marcus Steer is the Managing Director and CEO of Australian Tuna Fisheries and is a director of Kin Tuna, which was the first company to buy tuna under the new certification. He says it's fantastic to see tuna finally recognised under MSC after the industry's work to become more sustainable.
You know, like a lot of boxes needed to be ticked and you know, had to look at the fishery very closely and our farming practices and everything we do. So, like, it's incredibly positive news, you know, for all the members of the association and certainly for us and our company.
And so what has been put in place over... You've been involved in the industry for many years. Your father has been involved for many years. What have you noticed has changed to improve what the industry has been doing to be able to get this certification?
Look, the stock biomass levels in general are increasing. The industry itself is getting better. It's getting better managed, you know, in all aspects of the industry. You know, it's a wild catch certification. You know, so just generally doing everything better and knowing that the stock biomass levels are getting better. You know, that's a big part of the certification. You know, MSC is having, you know, very good, sustainable, stable fisheries. And, you know, we're one of the many to be attached to that label now.
Here in Port Lincoln, obviously the prawn industry has got the MSC certification. Is it something that you maybe might speak to them about, you know, the advantages that they've seen since having that from MSC?
Look, I think the MSC certification as far as sales and marketing and branding and product representation and sort of, you know, reaching out into new markets all over the world, you know, is something that the MSC label and really brand will really help us with. Like, the consumers have a myriad of seafood products and that they can choose from these days. If you look at the prawns, there's half a dozen different prawns the consumer can look at. If you look at tuna, there's half a dozen different species of tuna that the consumer can look at. So, like, if our Southern Bluefin Tuna can be fully certified and integrated into that system, well, then, you know, then it makes that market access entry point and the sustainability and all of that a lot easier for us. So for us moving forward for the next 20 or 30 years and having that certification, it is so incredibly important to us, you know, especially where the industry is now. We need new markets, and that tick, that certification, that brand, that will really help us to do that.
And I believe you've already sold the first tuna that can come under that certification. Is that right?
That's correct. Like Blaslof Fishing Group and Australian Tuna Fisheries, they are the two founders of Kin. And Kin is a sales and marketing and branding company that sells tuna all over the globe and into Australia. And we're selling different cuts of tuna, so we're trying to look at the value add as well, you know, the product development. Saku blocks and loins and, you know, we're just selling all different types. So for Kin to actually buy the first MSC certified southern bluefin tuna is absolutely fantastic, and hasn't been done anywhere throughout the world. So we're incredibly proud that Kin was the first.
So Kin bought that first tuna, and then what will they do with that moving forward from there?
So Kin's brought that tuna. Kin will develop a chain of custody, and we will freeze that fish, and we will saku block that fish down, and then we will get it out into the marketplace, and we'll sell it to different retail or food service distributors.
Marcus Steer there, Managing Director and CEO of the Australian Tuna Fisheries and a Director of Kin Tuna, speaking there to Brooke Neindorf. 20 minutes to one.
Get your footy fix on the ABC Listen app.
Can you believe it? A new game high.
Wherever you are and whatever you're doing.
He drives it home.
AFL and NRL.
Bing, bing, bing.
Live and ad-free on the ABC Listen app.
Well, like many parts of South Australia, the Clare Valley wine region has had historically low rainfall, and that's led to an increased need to irrigate the vines. It's estimated approximately 80% of vineyards are on mains water, the most expensive water for grape growers in the state. Anna Baum is the Executive Officer of the Clare Valley Wine and Grape Association. She says grape growers are managing water resources very carefully.
Well, it has been a dry year, and if you're not a grape grower that is connected up to the SA water pipeline, then it has been a really tough year here. Obviously, you know, the driest year in recorded history, and certainly our grape growers that are dry grown, have vineyards that are dry grown, have really had to think about how to manage their vineyards, make sure that they, you know, haven't got too much crop, etc., to manage that.
How common is dry grown grapes here?
We don't have any actual figures, but our best guess is that about 20-odd% of our vineyard area isn't connected to the SA water pipeline. That's certainly something that when we've been looking in the past to improve our setup for the future, that we want to make sure that we increase the reach of secure water for all our grape growers.
And so are those growers putting in water infrastructure, or how are they managing that?
So there are some areas of the Clare Valley that do not have access to the pipeline water, so they don't have the trunk lines that go to them, so they're not putting, you know, more infrastructure in to get irrigated water that way. But some are lucky enough to have groundwater and certainly use that. But in these past dry seasons, the groundwater resources have really declined, and so they're really having to manage their water really, really carefully. If they don't have water and they are absolutely dry grown, then they often use mulch, make sure that they don't have too many weeds to compete with the vines. They make sure that they don't have too much fruit on the vine so that the crop's low, so that there's not as much energy needed to ripen the crop, and those sort of things to manage.
Save the moisture.
That's exactly right.
And for those who do have access to the mains, my understanding is that it's Murray water. I assume that might add significant sort of cost to those growers this year. Would that be right?
Yes, yes, indeed. I mean, this year people who have had water have used a lot of it because it's been necessary to keep the vines going. It's a significant cost. We actually in the Clare Valley have the most expensive water in the state out of all the wine regions. It's considerably more expensive than other regions, so it's a significant cost to the industry.
I know sort of previously there's been a little bit of work or thinking into what alternative water sources there might be for the Clare Valley and for growers. Where is that up to at the moment?
Yeah, we've certainly, as an association, as the Clare Valley Wine and Grape Association, have led a lot of those investigations. And there's been several studies done in the last decade, certainly looking at alternative supply options. And as a region, you know, our view is that we really want a solution that is both climate resilient and climate independent. And so that's where we've been really focusing in asking the government to help us out with that. But at the moment, the last study, we did have a preliminary business case done a couple of years ago. All the options were fairly marginal and nothing has gone ahead with the government at this stage with that.
What do you think can be done?
In the long term, we'd really like to obviously secure a supply of good quality, reliable and affordable water for the Clare Valley. And we really want to work with the government towards that. And obviously in this year that's coming up to the election, we'll want to have some good conversations about what the government might be able to do in the future. Also, we want to make sure too in the short to medium term that we all have access to water in the SA Water Pipeline. We want to make sure our current arrangement is not restricting anyone. And at the moment, the system is really at capacity. And so there are a lot of people that can't get as much water as they would like and so are having to really, you know, use less water. And so we really need to work closely with SA Water to make sure that we can access adequate water for everyone who is currently on the pipeline, but also for the new people who want to join the pipeline. And that's been a real problem at the moment. We can't get any new people onto the pipeline. So it's a work in progress.
That's the Executive Officer of the Clare Valley Wine and Grape Association, Anna Baum, there speaking with Kate Higgins. It's 15 minutes to one. Well, speaking of water, it is too early, I'm told, to tell if floodwaters from southwestern Queensland will make their way into the Murray River system. That's according to a senior meteorologist. Now, the upper Darling River is expected to see significant flows in the next weeks, with 600 to 1,000 gigalitres expected to enter Menindee Lakes in the coming months. A senior meteorologist, Dean Naramore, explains what's known so far about river levels and inflows.
This water has, in the last few days, crossed into South Australia, particularly on the Diamantina River and also the Cooper River. We have seen major flooding around the Innaminka area as the water from the Cooper Creek has now flowed into South Australia. And all this water in southwest Queensland will continue to track southwards towards Lake Eyre and eventually will end up in Lake Eyre as we move through May, June and July.
We've heard predictions from Water New South Wales of significant flows of between 600 to 1,000 gigalitres likely to enter the Menindee Lakes in coming weeks. Can we expect those flows to make their way to the southern basin communities as well?
It's probably too early to say how far that will go. We are starting to see some rises on the Darling River as even further east of those rivers I mentioned earlier, where we've still got minor to moderate flooding on a number of rivers that feed into the Darling River, including the Namoi, the Barron, the Williams Creek, the Warrego River. They all feed into the Darling River. And then that's going to then obviously continue moving downstream, eventually to the Menindee Lakes. And then, finally, as we get down towards the Murray River around the Wentworth area, on the Murray, but that's still probably a few months away. I mean, it depends how much of that water will be lost as it goes through just general evaporation and seepage. But some of that floodwaters in southern inland Queensland and far northern New South Wales is making its way down into the Darling River, and we're likely to see increased flows there in the coming weeks and months.
Is there water expected to flow into the Lower Darling and into the Murray River system as well in coming months?
Probably too early to tell if it'll actually make it. We do know it's going to make it the northern reaches of the Darling, but it does take a very long time to move down the Darling into the Murray. So, definitely too early to say how much, if any, flow will make it towards the Murray River as we get into the winter season.
Could it be that none of the water makes it into the Murray River system?
Possibly, but again, it's too early to say. First, we've got to get a handle of how much water in all those feeder rivers, creeks and streams flows into the Darling. And then once we see how much water is in the Darling, we'll then get a better idea of, how far that flow is likely to occur and how much we may lose due to lakeage, seepage, evaporation, et cetera, et cetera. So, this early stage is still too early to say how much, if any, will get to the Murray River. We'll have a better handle on that in the coming weeks.
And the long-range forecast for southeastern South Australia and parts of western Victoria back in March was that it was expected there would be 60 to 70% of a chance of above average rainfall in April, May and June. Is that still the same, or has that long-range forecast changed for South Australia and western parts of Victoria?
Yeah, look, as we know, that the just those extremely bad drought conditions and dry continues right across parts of South Australia and Victoria. And unfortunately, in the coming months, we're still looking at probably below average rainfall, at least through the April, May, June period, and possibly even a bit longer than that.
Not some good news in that. That's Senior Meteorologist at the Bureau of Meteorology, Dean Naramore, and he was speaking there to Jessica Schremer. You're with Selena Green on the Country Hour today. We'll keep talking water because Far West New South Wales producers have renewed their calls for weather radars after the floods in southwest Queensland. The Pastoralists Association of West Darling have been calling for 3 weather radars in the region since 2017. And committee member Lachlan Gall says it would have been able to predict the recent weather event in southwest Queensland.
Essentially, I think the job can be done with 3 radars, one somewhere northeast of Broken Hill, perhaps in the Fowler's Gap area, a second one in the Tibooburra Cameron Corner area, which would extend coverage into southwest Queensland, and then a third one further north in southwest Queensland at a location to be determined by stakeholders in that neck of the woods close what is a very big existing gap in weather radar coverage.
Where are we currently getting our radar from then?
At the moment in Far West New South Wales, we get some radar coverage from the Mildura radar and the newish Brewarrina radar, but they have a maximum range of about 250 kilometres, and at the extreme ranges, the radar's only really looking at the tops of clouds, so anything could be happening in the middle and lower levels of the atmosphere and not show up on the radar screen. So sort of anywhere west of, say, about Tilpa or north of Broken Hill doesn't have any radar coverage at all, and even closer to Brewarrina and Mildura, the coverage is not that great at the perimeter of those radar coverage areas. Broken Hill and the surrounding area has got a long history of being affected by storm events, including but not limited to the major hailstorm that hit the city in November 16. There's also flooding and storm damage in Broken Hill in 2021 and 2022, and other storms that caused a lot of damage on pastoral properties not very far from Broken Hill. None of those storms showed up on radar coverage. The radar coverage that already exists in New South Wales only shows the rainfall and the storm events moving away from the far west area of New South Wales and further east towards the coast.
Lachlan Gall there, committee member with the Pastoralists Association of West Darling, speaking to Catherine Spackman. Well, Nationals leader David Littleproud was in Broken Hill recently. He said the coalition government had a program to roll out weather radars in 2020, but he says it was cut by the Labor government. He says he's committed to seeing the radars installed in that region.
We will go back to this model because we've just seen, and I'm just north of you here and my electorate, and I just saw 27 people nearly lose their lives in Adervale because they didn't have a radar station from the front that came across from the Northern Territory, because the closest radar was Alice Springs, 2,000-odd kilometres away. So we've made a commitment, and we're going to continue to make sure that we get these radars rolled out.
That is the Nationals leader, David Littleproud.
I think, like most of Australia, it would be the cost of living.
The issues for young people, like the cost of living and the cost of housing.
For the very latest on the federal election.
Electricity is terrible, really.
Stay with ABC Radio.
This is the Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Now, I had promised across to the Trade Minister, Joe Sokarch, live today. He flew out to China this morning on a trade delegation there. Very fitting, given it's been a year since China lifted its hefty tariffs on Australian wine. Unfortunately, we're told he has been caught up in a meeting in China and is unable to join us on the program today. So hopefully we'll be able to catch him for tomorrow's Country Hour. So instead, I'll bring you an update on what's happening with spinach and mixed salad products, which are back on supermarket shelves after E. coli detection sparked a wider recall. The bacteria was found in two prepackaged spinach products during routine checks in Queensland last month. And the cause of the contamination is still being investigated by food safety and health authorities. The Victorian Farmers Federation's horticulture group president, Nathan Free, he's not connected to the contamination in any way, but as he told Justine Longmore, he certainly feels very much for the growers involved.
A shiver went through my spine a little bit because I know what those farmers, growers and processors would be going through, because as a grower myself, we have safeguards put in place in case something like that ever happens. So a part of our quality assurance systems, we are asked to do a mock recall. So we're asked to do something that may never happen to our farm, but we have procedures in place. We've got testing facilities in place, and we've got all our other OH&S and all our other food safety measures to ensure that we're food safe. We've got quality assurance to whatever standard that we need for the certain customer we have. So knowing that someone's gone through that, it would be a very big toll on their business or their supply chain, and obviously they'll be working very hard to kind of fix this issue.
And is it something that's traceable? So packaged, bagged salads, contamination detected in Queensland. Can Food Standards Australia, New Zealand trace that back to the farm?
Yeah, no, everything is traceable, everything from the growing facility to the packing facility to if they're utilising a outsourced packaging supplier or something along those lines, like every product of every block in Australia is linked. So the bag numbers or the dates of best before that were on the products that were recalled will be linked back to a block, a packing shed, and whoever has dealt with that product down to the trucking line that has got temperature protocols in place as well. So there's a lot of different check-offs, and yes, it is very traceable.
In this case, I understand that there are about 50 products in a variety of supermarkets. Is that something that for farmers, you often are providing fresh produce for the whole country? How do you approach it as a grower, knowing that this is where your product's going?
So we've seen it across a lot of lines over the last 5 years or last 10 years. Maybe there was a bit of a scare with some carrots. Obviously, people are aware of the rock melon issues that with listeria. The industry is working furiously behind like a duck pedaling water. I mean, on top, it doesn't look like we're doing much, but the industry is working extremely hard to ensure the safety of fresh produce for the consumer.
With customers going back into the supermarkets, they're seeing this spinach and the mixed salads back on the shelves. What would be your message? What would you want them to think about when they're reaching or deciding what product to pick, either the recalled product that's been restocked or something else? What do you think people should know?
Customers need to be assured that the recall was put in place because there was an issue and it was picked up and it was cleaned up. So there's on-farm testing, there's government testing, and obviously even the supermarkets do their own independent testing to make sure that all these products are safe and sound for consumers. And I'm a consumer of said product. I can't grow everything for my household. So as a consumer, I'm very rest assured to know that, well, there's very stringent regulatory measures put on as a grower, as a packer, as a seller. So I know on the other side of it, the supermarkets, the government and transport organisations have got those same regulations on them as well. So I'm very confident that it will be very food safe and be ready to eat for any consumer.
That was Nathan Free speaking there. He's the Horticulture Group President with the Victorian Farmers Federation, and he was speaking there to Justine Longmore. If you want to read more about this story and this E. coli outbreak in spinach and mixed salad products, you can hop on the ABC Rural website. There's more to read on there, abc.net.au/rural. While you're on there, there's some great reading. You can read more about the impact of cheap cheese and dairy imports coming into Australia on the Australian dairy industry. That story went up yesterday on that website. There's also some extraordinary pictures on there of the flooding in northeast of South Australia, and those are parts of the state that are cut off by those floodwaters making their way across into our border from southwest Queensland. And a story that has got a big reaction this morning is also speaking with some farmers northwest of Brisbane who are now surrounded by what's described as the tallest wind turbines in Australia, and some great pictures with that story as well. So abc.net.au/rural. And don't forget, you can catch up with anything you've missed on the Country Hour on the ABC Listen app if you want to go download that onto your smartphone. That's it for me. It's coming up to 1 o'clock. I'll catch you tomorrow at noon for more Country Hour.
Australia Votes 2025. Make an informed decision this federal election. For everything you need to know, you can trust ABC Radio.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.